Drums, drums, drums. Through the sleepy country comes distant shudder of the drums. Reapers in the cornfields ponder, stop their work and idly wonder at the distant growing thunder. Drums and drums and marching feet. Soldiers marching, young and tall. And behind them, lest they fall, another reaper gathering all.
Well, ta-ta, love.
Riders from Paris, Tom.
Aye, well, and all. I'm from Berlin.
Goodbye, Tom. Give my love to Kaiser.
A long way to Tipperary, but my heart's like...
Never, in the words of Mr. Lloyd George, never was there a war so universally acclaimed. Mr. H.G. Wells published a pamphlet and coined a phrase for its title.
The war that will end war.
Rupert Brooke caught the mood of the hour.
Now God be thanked who has matched us with his hour and caught our youth and wakened us from sleeping.
And in Berlin...
The Kaiser commands a national day of prayer. I commend you to God. Go to church and kneel before God and pray for his help for our gallant army.
In Britain, the Archbishop of Canterbury announces a service of intercession with God to be used in all churches on behalf of His Majesty's naval and military forces. The poet J.C. Squire writes,
God heard the embattled nation sing and shout, God strafe England and God save the king, God this, God that, and God the other thing. My God, said God, I've got my work cut out. On August the 9th, the first transport ships are entering Boulogne Harbour.
Les Anglais! Ici les Anglais!
Are we down on it?
No!
Shall we beat them?
At this hour, a million Germans, the most formidable army on earth, are driving into Belgium. Towns and villages are wrecked and burned. With mammoth howitzers, the fortress of Liège is demolished. The first battle of the war.
This, says the German general von Moltke, is the struggle that will decide the course of history for the next 100 years.
The British Expeditionary Force, 100,000 men, the old contemptibles. Among the old contemptibles was a young officer named Lieutenant Horrocks, now General Sir Brown Horrocks.
This was, I should think, the last time there was any romance and glory attached to war. As I marched through those cheering crowds, I felt like a king among men. It was all going to be over by Christmas, and our one anxiety was to be out there in time. When I left Chatham, I had 95 men under command. But on arrival at Southampton, there were 98. Three men had hidden under the seats so as not to miss the battle. Seems extraordinary now, but that was the spirit. I was only 18. The officer in charge of a draft of reservists for the 1st Battalion, the Middlesex Regiment. But as all of them were old soldiers, it was they who conducted me to the front, and not me them. Looting was, of course, strictly forbidden. And when our troop train through France halted, as it frequently did, We officers leant from the window to ensure that the wayside crops were left untouched. Carrots, for instance. Not a soldier was ever to be seen. Yet the extraordinary thing was that carrots would be certain to figure prominently in the stew which the cooks provided for us that evening. My first lesson on active service was the astonishing capacity of the old soldier to look after himself and be as comfortable as possible under the most adverse conditions.
August the 20th, the Germans occupy Brussels. For 3 days and three nights, 320,000 men of von Kluck's army roll through the Belgian capital. Infantry, cavalry, guns, field kitchens, even horse-drawn cobbler shops to keep the men footshod as they go.
August the 23rd, the Battle of Mons.
At Mons, the small but highly trained British expeditionary force barred the way. Their rifle fire was so rapid and amazingly accurate that the German Goliath thought it had run into a nest of machine guns and hesitated. And mind you, that army of theirs was a Goliath. Tens of thousands of vehicles, hundreds of thousands of men set in motion to a meticulous timetable. They were carrying out their famous Schlieffen plan, swinging an enormous right punch through Belgium in order to outflank the French. This movement was to be swift and overpowering, and to start with, it was.
While the Battle of Mons was being fought, at home, queues of volunteers formed quickly at the recruiting stations under the poster with Kitchener's moustached face and pointing finger. One of the recruits was J.B. Priestley.
To most of us, the call was really little to do with king and country and flag-wagging and hip-hip hooray. It was a challenge to what we felt was our untested manhood. In centuries gone by, other men who hadn't lived as easily as we had drilled and marched and borne arms. Couldn't we? Yes, we too could leave home and soft beds and the girls to soldier for a spell. If there was some excuse for it, something at least to be defended. And here it was. In those first months, we believed that war still held movement, colour, adventure, and drama.
The 1914 war in its first phase was very open, a war of horses. I remember standing on a ridge during my first battle and watching the horse artillery galloping into action. It was a magnificent sight. Just what I, as a youngster, had always imagined warfare would be like. Shortly afterwards, I was joined by a gunner observation officer, who, pointing to a distant mass of cavalry, asked me if they were French or German. As the knowledge of foreign uniforms had not been included in my military education, I had no idea. Anyhow, he said, it's too good a target to miss. And very soon, his shells were bursting over those cavalry, who scattered in every direction. Whether they were allies or enemy, I never discovered.
Private Oscar Anderson of the BEF.
Such was the confusion of open warfare. The French cavalry, all dressed up in red tunics with shining breastplates, looked just like our own horse guards at home in Whitehall. Like the French infantry, who wore red trousers, they were sitting targets. We were grateful for our khaki, but in those early days, we had no tin hats, only cloth caps. During the hot days of the retreat from Mons, many of us threw away our packs. When it came on to rain, we had no cover from the weather. We'd had heavy casualties and were now just a struggling trail of silent and weary men. Going up to Mons, we had been singing Tipperary, but now it dwindled to one man whistling. Then the rest of the chaps called out, "Shut up!" Then there was silence except for the Jerry's booming guns behind us. I suffered from bleeding feet and I had an attack of dysentery. Finally, I had to give up the struggle to keep up with the regiment and join hundreds of others lying in the ditches. I was really past caring what happened to me.
That was Mons. But after our infantry had managed to break clear, it developed into mobile warfare with constant clashes between the cavalry of both sides. In fact, the old classic trumpet-blowing sort of war which armies had fought for centuries.
The cavalry, Private Webb of the 12th Royal Lancers, the charge at Moy.
On the 28th of August, 1914, It was a sweltering hot day. We were advancing up a ridge when suddenly we got the order to gallop. We saw the Germans in front of us, firing at us from behind the stooks in the cornfield. We heard the order then on the bugle to charge, and we put our lances under our arms and we went mad for them. We rode straight through them. We were shouting, screaming, and bawling our heads off, not taking any notice of anybody except going for the first German we could see. We were still charging with our lances down, and I saw one particular German, which I went for. I put my lance through him, and unfortunately, I left it there. I couldn't pull it out. I nearly came off my horse. I immediately drew my sword. We turned about, but the few Germans that were left were taken prisoner. I didn't have any occasion to use it.
Now, each month is signposted with those names which are forever England.
August, the retreat from Mons.
September, the victory of the Marne.
October, the battle of the Aisne.
The battle of Ypres. Terrible, deadly Ypres.
The small British expeditionary force was half destroyed, but somehow the line held. The Channel ports were saved, and most important, the German Galeas saw its timetable wrecked. Their magnificent military machine ground to a standstill. Winter was coming, and with it the rain, and above all the mud, in which their Schlieffen plan bogged down. A new element now appeared, an element which no one had considered and which was beyond their control and ours, trench warfare in fact. British, French, Belgians, Germans dug themselves in. There was something sublime in the endurance of these soldiers of all nationalities. But movement now disappeared from this terrible war. From the Alps to the North Sea, millions of men dug like beavers and disappeared underground to lead an almost troglodyte existence for years on end.
Now came disillusionment. For us were joined up in a fine spirit of adventure. The frenzied butchery of this war, indefensible even on a military basis, was eventually to kill at least 10 million young men. After being dressed in uniform, fed and drilled, cheered and cried over, these 10 million were then filled with hot lead, ripped apart by shell splinters, blown to bits, suffocated in mud, or allowed to die of diseases after rotting too long in trenches that they shared with syphilitic rats and typhus-infected lice. Death, having come into his empire, demanded the best and got it.
But people back home had a more glamorized view of war.
Oh, we don't want to lose you, but we think you ought to go. For your king and your country both need you so.
Back home in Britain, a very different atmosphere. No discomforts, no conscription, no air raids. No rationing, no shortages. Business as usual. And a popular song which is now a choice museum piece of 1914 jingoism. It purported to be every woman's call to every man.
We've watched you playing cricket and every kind of game. At football, golf and polo, you men have made your name. But now your country calls you to play your part in war. And no matter what befalls you, we shall love you all the more. So come and join the forces as your fathers did before. Oh, we don't want to lose you, but we think you. King and your country both need.
cheer you, thank you, kiss you when you come back again. Well, that's how people at home felt. Optimistic, comfortable, safe. They were surrounded by the sea and guarded by the Navy. It was a British tradition to be secure. It was more than 2 centuries since the fire of an enemy had scorched these islands. But suddenly...
December the 6th, 1914. German battleships bombard Scarborough, Whidbey, and the Hartlepools.
A recollection by Mr. Hyde, at that time a reporter on the Scarborough Evening News.
I went to bed and to sleep and was awakened 2 or 3 minutes past 8 by crashes of shells bursting. The whole of the overcast sky was flickering with crimson shell bursts. Naturally, I was in a great hurry to get dressed. More or less continuously, there was broadside after broadside.
2 German battle cruisers were firing 12-inch and 6-inch shells at Scarborough.
It was so unexpected on this quiet morning that it really was frightening. About 25 minutes after the bombardment began, our house was hit by a shell. My bedroom was smashed to bits. I found 4 or 5 pounds of jagged steel embedded in my pillow. The gunfire ceased as suddenly as it began, and as a reporter, I got onto the streets to see what had happened.
And one thing that naturally happened was a scare that the Germans were landing.
At that time, the newspapers had been full of pictures of refugees on the Belgian roads, and I saw pretty much the same thing. Motor cars and all manner of horse-drawn vehicles, hand carts, were going along the road, carrying loads of bedding and also conveying bedridden invalids. The damage was widespread, and of course, no one living in Britain had seen anything like this in our country. It was afterwards computed that between 500 and 700 shells had fallen on the town and the immediate districts.
Mrs. Foster, formerly Dorothy Cass Smith, daughter of the harbour master at Scarborough.
I was a schoolgirl at the time. We lived inside the lighthouse, and at breakfast time we heard a noise like very loud thunder. Father thought that it would be safer if we left the lighthouse, so he told Mother to take me down the pier. Mother and I looked over the parapet and saw 2 big ships in the distance and the guns flashing, a bright orange like a furnace door being opened. So Mother took me down the pier, and as we were going down, we saw all the men coming off the trawlers like a lot of scared rabbits. And we all went down together and sheltered under this parapet. And the thing I remember most was the tremendous noise. And the shells were flying over us, and we could see all the houses tumbling down like sandcastles. The Grand Hotel was hit 2 or 3 times, and the old castle walls, we could see it all. And the noise was so tremendous because it reverberated against the castle hill. And all of a sudden, there was a lull. And Mother said, "We haven't any money and we've left the deed box behind. So shall I go back?" My mother returned to the lighthouse, but within 5 minutes she was back with us. She said, "I didn't go in because just before I got there, a shell went right through the lighthouse tower."
Total killed at Scarborough, Whidbey, and the Hartlepools, 149.
Now the savagery of war was beginning to be brought home to civilians.
Christmas Eve, 1914. A German aeroplane flies over Dover and drops a bomb for the first time on English soil.
The very first bomb. And now, cutting right across a swiftly increasing bitterness, came the voice of Pope Benedict XV. He appealed to the warring governments to make a general truce for Christmas Day. It seemed a suitable moment for a truce, for in the words of the Times newspaper,
"The world is fuller of wounded and broken men than it has ever been in its history."
but the governments declined.
Our Christian initiative, said the Pope, was not crowned with success.
But what governments would not do, ordinary men could and did. Christmas Eve, 1914, in the front line. A memory by Charles Brewer, then a lieutenant in the Bedfordshire Regiment.
It was a still, frosty night with a clear half moon. For once, it wasn't raining. As we looked over the top row of sodden sandbags, we could easily see the German trench and barbed wire not 100 yards away across the slimy, churned-up morass of no man's land. A body or two lay out there. Everything was still, except for the occasional far-off tocka-tocka-tock of a machine gun. In my own strip of waterlogged trench, a chill sentry stamped and beat his mittened hands. Suddenly, he saw a group of glistening lights appear on the German parapet. And then, on the still air, came a sound new to the Western Front. I was fetched up from my dugout. I had a good look and saw that the lights were on a Christmas tree. A Christmas tree with candles. Further along the line, I could see more Christmas trees sparkling. We gave the Jerrys a cheer, and then one of our chaps said, here, let's sing them something back. Come on.
We are Fred Garner's army, the ragtime infantry. We cannot fire, we cannot shoot, what blinking use are we? And when we get to
a distant German voice shouted, Hola, English! A Merry Christmas! What were these Germans like who shouted to us across no man's land? These fellows we'd been shooting at for months. Well, now, 50 years later, I can introduce you to one of them. At Christmas 1914, he was in the very stretch of the German line opposite where I was. Here's Dr. Josef Seewald of Augsburg in Germany, in 1914, a young officer in the 17th Bavarian Regiment.
I was the son of a farmer in Bavaria. I was 24 and conscripted to the army. We were in the trenches, and we all had thought that war would be over till Christmas. Our emperor, Willem, had said that we would be at home when the leaves of the trees fall down. But there were no trees with leaves. It was war just as ever.
It was war just as ever. We too had thought we should all be home by Christmas.
The trenches were terrible, full of water. I shouted to our enemies that we didn't wish to shoot, and that we made a Christmas truce. I said I would come from my side and we could speak together. First there was silence, then I shouted once more, invited them, and the British shouted, no shooting. Then came a man out of the trenches, and I, on my side, did the same. And so we came together and we shook hands. a bit cautiously.
Later, when dawn broke, we saw several Germans standing on top of their parapet and waving to us. We also clambered out, picked our way through the wire, and there, in no man's land, disregarding the dictates of imperial systems and the propaganda of a screaming press, we solemnly shook hands and wished each other the compliments of the season. Everybody seemed a bit shy. Dr. Seewald remembers a particular request that one of our officers made to him.
The lieutenant said there was a comrade who had been killed, and they wished to bury this man here. And I said, why not? Of course you can do it. And so they brought the dead man, laid him in the ground, and we all laid a handful of earth upon the dead man and together prayed the Lord's Prayer. Vater unser, der du bist in dem Himmel. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And it was really inspiring.
We spent all day out there in no man's land. The bagpipes of the Second Gordons provided Scottish music for this extraordinary Christmas. One of our chaps brought out a football and started a match with the Germans. And they even shaved each other.
The soldiers would kneel down and held up their head to be shaved by the English. And on the other side, the German soldiers shaved the English soldiers. And it was laughter and joy. And it was as if never had been any disturbance between the feelings of these thousands of young men. The generals did, of course, know nothing. And we were very careful to make it impossible that any news got back to the generals, to the staff officers.
The Christmas truce was limited to only parts of the Western Front. Nevertheless, it was an amazing happening for the juggernaut of war to be brought to a stop by ordinary soldiers.
We swapped coat buttons and exchanged bully beef for cigars. You know, that was responsible for the biggest laugh of the day. The amazement of our men at finding every German with a well-filled cigar case. I remember our sergeant, Rags Nichols, saying, "Blimey, Alf, it's a millionaire's battalion." Then the Germans were singing again. It was something we all knew, so we all joined in.
When we heard the Englishmen, we began to sing also louder and louder, and all at once it was like a hymn that arose out of the trenches to the sky. Christmas was a thing that united the enemies, and it is wonderful to think that the thought of Bethlehem would unite the men. The men heard the voice of 2,000 years back, but the rulers did not hear. And so war went on for 4 years, and millions of young men had to die.
With the passing of Christmas, the troops went back to their trenches. From generals and governments came reprimands for the men of the Christmas truce. The war must go on. And it went on.